Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to cover some more. Good afternoon, everyone. So today we're going to cover some more about C, but first some selected anonymous feedback. Some people liked asking questions. If I finish the first lab before my lab time, do I still have to go? No, you didn't. Probably not so useful to know that now. This is going to be generally true for labs that you don't have to actually do in the lab. If you finish outside of your lab, we don't care if you're there. You can still go there if you want. You can ask questions of the TAs other than about the lab. It's fine. How much extra credit is offered for each phase? So the homework is out of 30. You get 2 extra points on that for each phase you complete without any explosions in that phase, 1 extra for each phase you complete with some explosions in that phase. Can we get keys to previous quizzes? So if you don't know, on the website under documents, I should probably make this bigger, there are old quizzes and old exams linked. They don't have keys for the quizzes. Unfortunately, getting for pre-fall 2016 keys would be remarkably annoying. I'd probably have to get Luther Tikhanovich to give me access to the old CoLab sites and then look at the CoLab quiz interface and figure it out manually. Not really worth doing. And you might want to reuse quiz questions. I'm probably not going to just make them readily available for even the fall 2016. Though you can certainly ask us during office hours or something, or on Piazza, what the answer to an old quiz question is if you're confused about it. And in the more usual feedback category, the quiz questions are overly difficult, and Lab 1's 20 explosions rule is overly punitive. Bear in mind that some of us only have a few years of CS experience prior to this class. I do try to assume that most people don't have CS experience before college, since that's commonly the case. And yes, I understand I usually write difficult quiz questions. Some of this is a mistake, like I sometimes make forward references on the quiz I should know better than to. We have the disadvantage that the quizzes are the assignments where there's the least turnaround time between writing them and giving you them, so there's the least edited. So that happens, but I do intend to write quiz questions which actually require thinking and not just finding something in the textbook and copying it to the answer. That is intentional. I don't want people to just, it's not just search for something in the text and copy, look for the phrase which exactly answers the question. It's not what I'm trying to write. As for the 20 explosions rule, if you're getting lots of explosions on the lab, you're probably doing something systematically wrong, and that's mainly there to indicate that if you're getting close to that, you should be rethinking your approach. In particular, note that you can set a breakpoint before the explosion happens. This is a common at the function that might do that. If you can figure out what that is, that's a very common and perfectly valid strategy. And the most common way I've seen people accidentally get explosions is typically by running step I, step I, step I, step I, enter, 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 to repeat step I over and over again, losing track, and then oops, it's too late. And that's usually not actually a very productive way to figure out what's going on, because if you're just pressing enter rapidly and not really looking at what's going on, you probably aren't figuring things out. Some people do this because they don't know how to set a breakpoint in the middle of some function you don't have source code for, which I probably should have added to the lab write-up. So it turns out that if you know the address of an instruction, say from the disassembly you get in the debugger or from object dump, you can set a breakpoint at that exact address with this syntax in GDB, which might be useful. So you should absolutely not need to just step I 50 times, which is not very helpful and also error prone. Yes?
I actually had an explosion for phase 1 when I was working on phase 2. Does that explosion count for phase 2?
It counts for phase 1. Yes. Yes?
So I think there was some, the info label was committed to mention in the lab.
Yeah.
To show the local variables. It was mentioned in the lab specifically as something that you use to kind of debug the code.
Yeah.
But when you, like, upon actually doing that, it says it's just going to open data. Is that just because it was compiled with SQL? Like, is that to be expected?
That's, it's probably normal. It would make sense that the phase functions were not compiled with information about their local variables.
Like, threw me off because it was included specifically as one of the, like...
It works for main, for example. It should work for main. If it doesn't, then we didn't compile, then it's not compiled with debug information. It's generally a useful command, which you might use yourself, which is the purpose of the lab is not just to solve the homework in the lab. Hopefully. Yeah. So, any non-anonymous feedback, comments, questions besides last? Okay. So, last time we went through how compilation, assembly, and linking worked with some examples for what were in those files. And we reviewed a bit of x86-64, which hopefully is helpful for the lab. And we talked a bit about C data types and how 0 is the false value in C. And we went through pointer arithmetic and finished up on arrays and pointers. So before I move on, any questions on these topics from last time? Yeah. So a little bit more then about arrays and pointers. So I said last time that this and this are exactly the same in C, that arrays turn into pointers when you try to use them like a pointer. And because of this, many people sort of get the impression that arrays and pointers are basically, basically the same thing, but this isn't actually true. So, for example, if I declare an array and a pointer like this, I can assign the pointer to the array. And this is the same as taking a pointer to the first element. That's that decay thing that turns into the first element pointer. But I can't do the opposite. There are multiple things you might guess this would do. It doesn't matter. It's illegal. It's an error. So whatever you thought it does, it doesn't do that. Another difference is that, yeah?
Should that be a compilation error or a...
It should be a compilation error. This should not compile. So you might say, well, doesn't that mean that just arrays are constant pointers? And that's also not quite true. So the C compiler, when you ask what the size of an array is, it's going to tell you how much stuff is actually in that array. The array actually knows about its size. It's part of its type and part of what's going to be used to compute its size. So in this case, it would be 400 on our lab machines because ints are 4 bytes and there's 100 of them. If I ask the size of the pointer, it doesn't matter what it points to. It's going to be how much space it takes to represent that address, which on our lab machines is 8 bytes, regardless of what the pointer happens to be set to right now. So what's going to happen if I ask for that size? Sorry? Someone 8. So people say, so it's the same, this is a pointer, since we're explicitly taking the address of the first element of the array, so this is 8. It's not 4. We've gotten rid of the information about how big the array is by taking a pointer to its first element explicitly. Okay, so any questions about these sizes? So this means that I can find how large an array is by taking the size of the array and dividing it by the size of one of its elements. But I can't do that for a pointer that happens to point to an array. That's not going to work. And it's not going to be an error. It's just going to give me the wrong value. So last time I had some examples where I initialized strings to arrays and pointers, and I kind of glossed over what the difference was. So this first thing here, take say pointer to this constant. That constant's going to be in our read-only data. If we have multiple instances of the same string, we might get the same pointer. And we are not allowed to change things through this pointer, even if I remove the word const here, which I can do and will compile, even though that doesn't make sense. I'm not allowed to change this string through that pointer. It's not. If I remove const, it's not even a compile error, but it's not legal and could crash or do something else. This syntax creates an array. So if this is in a function, it's going to be on the stack. If it's outside a function, it's going to be a global variable. And that array will have a copy of what's in this string. So if it's on the stack, the compiler will generate code which will copy hello world to the stack. It's part of this. And this is going to include the null terminator. So this means if I ask what the size of array is, I'm going to get the number of characters in the string, including that null terminator I didn't write explicitly. If I ask the size of the pointer, it's going to be 8, the size of the address, that is the address of this string, somewhere in the read-only data part of our program. So any questions on either of these things? Okay, so now I'm going to switch from C to an apparently different topic. We'll get back to tying it back to C, of talking about using the command line. So in this course, you have to use a command line a lot, logging into the Unix servers, and you haven't really received much advice about doing that, and we want to make sure that you actually know about some things which are commonly known by people who use Unix a lot that we just don't end up teaching earlier. And we look at people in office hours and say, oh, I wish they knew that. So one of the things is that there is a manual. So there's manuals for all the commands you can possibly run. In fact, they're accessed through a command, and that command is called man, for menu. And if I want to find out how the man command works, I can read its manual, which is accessed through the man command. So I man for the man command, and I want info about man. And I get its manual. Very thorough. Tells me that man is an interface to the online reference manuals. And it gives me all the possible ways I can run the man command. In this sort of syntax, the brackets represent an optional argument. Otherwise, I think it's fairly straightforward. So man, optional section, and page. This page is called man. It's in section 1, which you can see from the parentheses up there. And that's what I accessed, and I didn't provide any of these many, many optional arguments. Now, usually just reading this won't get you very far, and many man pages helpfully contain a section titled, like, examples, which when it's there is usually where I'd like to start. So this tells you, that's how you get the manual page for LS. Tells you that sometimes there are multiple available manual pages with some name, and you can use dash A to get all of them. And it gives some other examples of things you might do with the man command. So if you wonder what some command on the command line does, this is how you can find out definitively. And you should be aware of it, because if you want to know what does tar do, what does gzip do, what options can I pass to ls, this is where you find that out. Right. And let's look at one particular command we're going to want to go through, which is chmod. So chmod is a command to change file mode bits, which is not actually a very helpful explanation. So files in, say, your home directory on the lab machines have mode bits, which are mostly about permissions. Who can access the files? So if you ever tried to access a file and got permission denied, that's because the mode bit said that you weren't allowed to access them. And you can change who can access the files that you own on the servers, and this is the command to do that. And ordinarily, I just show you an example from this man page, but it's actually not that helpful. So I have a worked out example. So here is an example of a chmod command, which passes the dash dash recursive option, which if you look at with the man page, says it goes through files and directories recursively. That means it's going to look at home user and everything inside home user, including things inside directories, inside directories, inside home user. It's going to take all those files, and it's going to change their mode bits, change things like who can access them, based on this very opaque specification. And what this means is that we first have a prefix part saying the mode bits for who accessing the file, and the second part is what type of permissions. So first we have O and G, O for others, meaning people who don't own the file and aren't part of the group that owns the file. And for your lab accounts, the group that you're in and the group that is assigned to your files is the student group that contains all students. And the minus sign here means to remove some bits, and R stands for read. So if you don't run a command like this, it turns out that your home directories done in your lab Unix account is world readable. That you can read anyone's home directory, you shouldn't do this, but just like to point that out, and you might want to do this for that reason. Hopefully eventually you'll get the IT people to make it not world readable by default, so we don't have to worry about any nefarious people reading other people's files. So you might wonder what other things are possible. So can you change your own permissions for a file? And the answer is yes. So there's also a U for user. You can set it so you can't read your own files until you change back their permissions. And in addition to read, there's write permission and execute permission. And you can, of course, add permissions, not just remove them. So any questions on this? Yes?
Is there a way to remove your own execution permission so that you can't add a permission for yourself later?
You can always change the permissions on files you own, regardless of what those permissions are. So yeah, if you own it, you can always fix it, though you'll have an awkward time if you make your home directory not readable by you. But you can always change permissions on files you own. So it's not a problem, technically. Other questions? OK. So this is one thing that might come up again. And if you work on Unix systems, you'll probably come across a case where you need to change file permissions. And it's good to know what this actually does rather than copy and paste blind ideas about making things world readable or writable. So another utility that we're going to commonly use is tar. And tar also has a man page, which is arguably more useful. It suggests there's a create, append, list, update, extract options. Well, it's a bit more useful. I have a summary here. So for the bomb lab, you've already used tar, because we gave you an archive in this format, and you extracted it, hopefully, to access your bomb. And the tar command is a bit strange compared to other commands on Unix because it has an interesting history. And you probably just extracted the bomb and didn't do anything else. I'd like to tell you how to do other things with tar archive, since this is commonly how we will distribute things to you. And you might want to create them yourself if you want to, say, copy something from the lab machine as an archive pretty easily. This is useful to do. So tar takes commands without any dash after the first option saying what to do. So for example, if I want a table of contents, if I want to list what's in an archive without extracting it and messing up the directory I'm currently in, I can use tar tf and then the file name. So the T stands for table of contents. The F stands for file. It stands for file because tar by default assumes you want to use your tape drive. Probably don't have a tape drive, but back when tar was written, this was the good assumption. It's a tape archive program. That's where the name comes from. It was from back when people were backing things up on tapes. To extract an archive, you can use tar xvf and a file name. So the x stands for extract, and the v stands for verbose. So you don't actually need the v, but if you don't have the v, tar is just going to extract the files and not tell you anything about what it just did. So extract the files, and you'll type ls, and you'll see there's more files in the directory you're in. Personally, I usually want to know what files tar just created for me, so I add that v. And probably you want that. Similarly, to create a tar archive, you can use tar c for create, and then I have vf again for verbose and file. If you don't use a v, it will just create the archive and not tell you anything about what it's putting in it. You'll have to type tar tf to figure out what it did. So you give a file name, and you can specify any number of directories or files you want to put in the archive. Okay. Any questions about tar? Yeah.
What does the dash do again? On our lab, what does the dash do in front of the?
In front of the tar?
Yeah.
Dash XF. Yeah, that's the same. Right. So tar in our lab machine supports both with a dash and without. You might come across some older machines where it doesn't, which is why I didn't show that syntax on that slide. Okay. So some other things I'd like to mention about the command line. So one thing is that there is completion. So let's say I want to go into a directory here. And I know it's spring 2017, and that's pretty long to type. So I'm just going to type the first few characters, SPR, and I'm going to press tab. And my shell completed the rest of that for me, so I didn't need to misspell spring. So that seems pretty useful, and I can keep doing this. So I have a 30-30 directory in here. So I type the first few letters, and it will complete that for me. So this is useful to know, and I'm telling you about it because we often see people in office hours and we're looking over their shoulder and we're, oh, are they spending so much time typing file names? So this works in general. It also works for commands. So I know there's a command starting with gzi, it's gzip, I can tab complete that. And it does something different when you have an ambiguous case. So for example, in my spring 2017 folder, I have two directories starting with CS. So if I type CS and then ask to tab complete it, at first it doesn't do anything. And if I press tab again, it tells me what the possibilities are. So it tells me that I probably should type a 3 or a 4 and then tab if I want to finish that. And this also works for commands. So I know that there's a command starting with TA for making archives. I can type TA and type tab twice, and it will tell me what all the commands that I have available to me that start with TA are. So another thing you may be aware of is that we have the ability to, you have the ability to use arrow keys to edit the middle of a line. It also happens that up arrow works. And down arrow to go through commands you've run recently. So if you mistype a command, you can go up and edit it however you like, rather than retyping the whole command. There's also a history command which will show you all the commands you've recently run. So if you forgot what you did before, you can look at the history and try to look for the command in there. So we're not going to test you on this, but we think that this will make labs and homeworks a lot on the lab machines a lot more productive for you, which is why we're telling you about it. So any questions about this? Any? Thanks. Okay. In that case, let's go back to C. So in some examples I showed you, I used standard io.h. And this is because there's no IO stream in C. All that C out stuff you were used to does not exist in C. You can't use it. It's not there. And you might wonder, how can I find out how standard I/O works? Where can I read about that? One option you would have is just Googling it. But we told you about manual pages, and it turns out that there is a manual page for standard I/O. And it says that standard I/O, which you can access by including standard io.h, is the standard input-output library functions. And it tells you in the synopsis that it declares something called standard in, standard out, and standard error, which we've never actually used. And you might remember there's a few functions in there. And if we go down further in here, there's a list of functions. And each of these functions has their own man page. So if you ever want to find out definitively how to do IO in C, how one of the functions you've seen actually works, what the arguments to printf are, etc., you can find out in the man pages. If you want to look for a function to do some type of IO, you can look in this index here. Okay. So we see all our usual functions, including printf here, that we've seen before, puts, which I used briefly, are all listed in here, and they all have their own man pages. And this is generally true for everything in the C standard library. It has a man page. You can look it up. And that's what you should do if you want the documentation. It's not going to be a tutorial typically, but it will tell you exactly what the function does, what it returns, when it has an error, etc. So I'm going to give a little introduction to the most commonly used of these functions, which is printf. And you might think that the thing we would do is type man printf. And that kind of seems to work. But we're getting something which takes a dash dash help option. It looks like a command. And it is. And the problem here is that this is the user command printf, which does something similar to the C function printf, but it's a command you can run in your terminal. It formats data. And it's in section one of the manual. And you remember that when we looked at man-man, we had this example for finding all the available pages for something. So we want a different man page for a different printf, the one that's the C function. So we can do that minus A for all option. And let's look at all the man pages for printf. So first it's going to show us the one that we just saw, the first one, because it's in the lowest numbered section one. And we can say, well, I don't want that. I'm going to press Q to quit. And then it's going to say, hey, next I'm going to show you the one in section 3. And I'm going to press Enter and look at that. And, well, that looks like the one I actually wanted. And here you have the full documentation for printf and some related functions that act very much like printf, including what everything does. But I'm going to give you a briefer summary, starting with an example. So printf, unlike cout, takes a template string with some placeholders, followed by things to put in those placeholders. So these are basically equivalent. So this %d here means this is a placeholder for an integer. And then I pass an integer in as an extra argument. Similarly, this %s is a placeholder for a string, and I pass the string in as an extra argument. And you, as the caller of printf, are responsible for making sure you use the right type of placeholder with the right type, with the same type of argument. If you don't do that, maybe you'll get an error, maybe you won't, maybe something weird will happen. And so this means, unlike cout, you can't interleave the things you want to fill in and what you have. That's just the way it works. So any questions about this? Yeah. Basically, no. There's probably a limit, but I mean, printf is going to be called using the same calling convention we know, and we don't actually know of a limit to the number of arguments you can pass. It's just that sometimes we have to use the stack. There might actually be a limit, but it's probably like in the 100-ish range. But I don't think so. So %d and %s are things you have to know about and look up. And I have a short table. There's a more complete information on the man page. And there's all these options and more for specifying the placeholder and what that means. And each placeholder has a particular kind of argument it expects. So %s expects some sort of pointer to char, and it treats it as a string. It's a C string, so it looks for a terminating null. If it's not there, something bad will probably happen. There's also a way to print out any pointer. That's %p, accepts any kind of pointer. You don't need to cast it, just any kind of pointer. And it will print it out on our lab machine, something like this, showing you the address of that. So %d you saw in that example represents a signed integer. It can accept an int, a short, or a char. I know that doesn't make much sense, that we can accept any of those types, but not just any type, but that is how it works, for historical reasons primarily. So it takes an int, a short, or char and prints it out as a decimal number. There's also %u, which takes an unsigned int, short, or char, and prints that out as a decimal number. But it's unsigned, so if it's large enough that it matters, it will not print out a negative sign. There's %x for printing out in hexadecimal, and like it prints out in this format, so decimal 42 is hexadecimal 2a. There's no preceding ox. You have to add that to the template if you want it. So these specifiers here for integers take things which aren't bigger than an int. If you want to pass along, you're supposed to use %ld or %lu for an unsigned long or %lx for printing out a long in hexadecimal. If you don't do it, it might sometimes work, but it's in general an error and might fail. So this extra character here, this L, applies to everything. You can also print out floating point values, and there's multiple ways of doing that. So %f prints out something with a decimal, and by default, six places after the decimal, you can change that format by reading the man page how to do that. You'll add something to this %f to do that. And it accepts either a double or a float, in spite of those being different sizes, yes. Either of those is fine. And it prints it out in this sort of format. There's percent %E for a float in, or double in scientific notation. And percent %G tries to choose between printing it out normally or scientific notation based on the size. So it prints out 42 as a normal decimal number, since it's kind of the right size. It prints out 4.2 to the 10 times 10 to the negative 9th in scientific notation, rather than trying to write 0.00000 and so on. So another thing you're often going to need to do with printf is print out a percent sign. If you say compute a percentage, you might want that. And you have to use %% for that. If you use percent space, that's might mean something different. And so that's how you specify an explicit percent sign. And this doesn't take an argument. You don't need to put anything, you don't, if you have a percent sign, you don't add anything to the argument list to put it in there. So any questions on any of these? Okay, so as I said, if you actually need to look up how to do something in detail, like you want to know how do I change the width of a number, etc., this is all in the full documentation, which I didn't actually show the command for. So I showed you could use man minus a, but there's another form of man, which is that we know that this is section 3 from the top of the man page, and I can go directly to section 3 by typing man, the section number, 3 in this case, and the page in that section. This will take me directly to the printf man page. So that's printf. So I'm going to catch up some nits in C. So this is something which is technically in C++, but you probably haven't seen it. And that's that goto is a thing that exists in C. You can label a statement, just like you would label something in assembly, and you can goto that. You aren't allowed to do this in between functions, but this in fact works, and you'll probably see it in some C code sometime. A lot of people don't like doing this. I've chosen an example deliberately where it makes sense, because I can't just break out of this doubly nested loop. I would need to have like an if statement here in order to avoid it. Some style guides will tell you you should have that if statement. Other people are fine with doing this. And this is basically exactly equivalent to the compiler just inserting a jump for you here and a label here. Yeah?
Well, how can people tell you not to do it? So
using goto in cases where something like if will work is generally considered confusing and less clear code. That's the main reason people tell them not to do it, is that they've seen code like that where people are using goto where there's a language construct which also works and is easier to read, at least they think. But I chose an example where there's not a language construct because I want to give an example what at least some people will say is a good idea. Another common case you might see for goto is error handling code at the end of a function because C doesn't have exceptions. Any other questions about goto? Okay, so this actually exists in C++, though you've probably never used it. Now I'm going to talk about something which is different. So you've seen structs in C++, but structs are going to be different in C. So I gather that many of you may have learned that structs are something different from classes. Who here was taught that structs are different from classes? Who here was taught that structs are the same as classes? Okay, so that structs are different from classes is a nice little, is not that true. So it turns out in C++, structs are exactly the same as the class except they default to public. This means it is technically legal in C++ to have methods in your structs. This is not a thing that C will have. So in C, structs really can't have methods, are just a bunch of values. That's not actually the case in C++, though we probably didn't teach you that kind of C++. And another big difference is you notice in this code, I'm using struct rational. I'm not saying rational 2.5. To declare an instance of this struct, I'm saying struct rational. If I just said rational, that would not work. There is no type called rational after I declare the struct like this. The type is called in C struct rational. So you might say that that's awfully inconvenient. Why would I, you know, I don't like typing struct all the time. And we're going to have an alternative for that. So who here has seen typedef? Who here has not seen typedef? OK. So we're going to use a generic mechanism called typedef, which lets you define a type as another name for an existing type. So we're going to declare our struct, which for clarity I'm calling other name for rational. We're just going to declare that as usual. And this creates a type called struct other name for rational, a really long name. And we're going to use typedef to make rational an alias for that. So the way typedef works is that you do exactly what you would do to declare a variable of that type and put typedef in front of it. And instead of declaring a variable, it declares another name for the type with the name the variable would have had. So in this case, the name is rational for struct other name for rational. So rather than typing struct other name for rational twice, we just type rational. So any questions on what this does? Yes?
Could you just walk through it again, please?
OK. So this declaration here defines a type called struct other name for rational. That is the whole name of the type, and there's not a shorter one we can use. Since that's very inconvenient, you want to define an alias for that, which typedef lets us do. And the way we construct a typedef statement is we do exactly what we would do to declare a variable of that type with the name of the we want for the alias and just put typedef in front of it. Yeah?
Can you typedef anything?
Yes, so I could typedef int to another name if I wanted. That you'll actually see code do that, and all sorts of other types, arrays, etc. Yeah?
You said in C++, structs are the same as classes, but they default to what?
Public. Oh. Which I guess hasn't come up in the C++ you've seen, but if you look at like commercial C++, you'll often see structs in C++ with methods, which is legal in C++ and not in C. Yeah?
So when you're initializing the rational in the last slide, you're doing struct rational equals whatever. If you just wanted to make it so you don't have to type struct in front of it, can you just do typedef struct rational and then rational?
Yes. Okay. So the only reason I'm using a different name here and here is not because it's required, but because it's less confusing to you
sure. To
not have the same name. But in fact, struct rational is completely independent of rational. They can be different things in C. It's not like C++ where struct rational creates rational. Yeah?
Will using typedef affect everything below the typedef?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
So other questions? So this sort of aliasing is very common. And in fact, there's a shorter way of writing it in C that you will commonly see. So rather than writing out this, I can put this struct declaration and the typedef on the same line, which is kind of surprising, but that's something I can do. I can say define struct other name for rational as containing numerator and denominator and typedef it in the same line. So this is exactly the same, just shorter, and you'll very commonly see code which does this. And if I'm doing this, I might say, I don't care about having this other name for the type. I'm never going to type struct other name for rational. Why am I bothering typing other name for rational at all or anything there? I don't want that. And in fact, you can omit that, in which case there won't be another a name starting with struct for the type, but it still works. So this is the same as this, except it doesn't define that second name starting with struct for the type. The only type defined from this after the semicolon is rational, rather than there being another type starting with struct that's defined. And you'll commonly, in C code, see both of these for declaring structs, because some C programmers don't like typing struct all the time. So any questions on these? I know, sorry. Usually this is confusing because it's weird that you can actually define a struct in the middle of a declaration, but you can. Okay, so you might ask, why would you ever see this form? And there is a reason for that. And here is one example of where we would want that. So this defines a type list, which represents a node in a linked list. And we have a pointer to the next node in it. And it probably would be more natural if we could just write list star next. But the list type does not exist until after this semicolon. So we can't do that. But we can immediately, after we say struct list T, refer to list T as a type and use it to make a pointer to that. So you'll commonly see the struct name used this way when we have recursive structures which have pointers to themselves. So this is a case where we actually care about that name, even if we're not going to use it for the rest of the code. Yeah?
Are the fields in the struct aligned linearly in the memory?
Are they aligned?
Linearly?
I'm not sure what you mean. They are consecutive in memory. The first field listed will have a lower address than the next field. There might be some blank space between fields. Yeah.
It seems like what's the point of the type that, like, when they were creating C, why didn't they just make it so you go in the struct state and the struct?
I assume the answer is history, as with most things in C which don't make sense. But it does turn out in C that struct names are, like, the struct namespace is a different namespace than normal types, right? So if I define, like, struct rational and rational could both be types and could be different types. I don't recommend doing this, but this is really possible. And for example, like, standard libraries probably accidentally took advantage of being able to find a struct something and a function called something. So for example, on Unix, there is a function called stat, which takes a struct stat, which wouldn't work, obviously, if stat was the name of the type. So they're kind of stuck with supporting things like this. And I'd also like to remind you, I think you've seen it before, but it's good to have a refresher, how we actually do dynamic lists in C, because we don't have new or delete. So our equivalent of new is malloc. Malloc takes a size. There's this convenient size of operator, which is usually what you want to use. So this allocates space for one instance of this struct, and then we initialize its items. We don't have a constructor, because those don't exist in C. And eventually, later on, we free it, which is the same as delete in C++. Any questions on this? So this does that logical one-element list with a pointer to null at the end. So you can also allocate dynamic arrays the same way. So if I want 100 ints, remember that our arrays are basically like pointers. So this will act very much like an array, even though it's a pointer, once we set it to point to some space we allocate that holds 100 integers worth. And we're just using the same malloc function. In C++, you'd use this new int bracket syntax. Here, we just specify the size. Malloc doesn't know about the type. And later on, we free it since we used malloc. Unlike C++, there's not a different free function for arrays. Malloc and free don't care whether it's an array or not. So this sets up array to point to some space on the heap and gets initialized to 0 to 99. Yeah?
It's kind of a random question, but like, why is it plus plus I and not I plus plus?
I have a habit of writing plus plus I, which is doesn't matter in C. There are cases where it matters in C++ where when I is not an integer type. But, which is why I have the habit. Other questions? Okay. And so you might say, well, this is usable, but it's kind of inconvenient compared to the vector you're probably used to from C++. In particular, you can't ask the size of this array. If you say size of array, you're going to get 8, the size of the pointer, size of this thing. There's no way you can query how big this is, besides remembering what you passed to malloc. So if you want something like vector, you need to track what you passed to malloc yourself. And in a later lab, we will use a structure like this, which you might see in some C code. Just implement vector yourself. Keep track of what size you passed, along with a pointer to that data on the heap. And we can set this up, you know, pretty simply. So initializing a 100 element vector, this is sort of the equivalent in C with this representation. That we have a size, and we allocate space for 100 elements, and then we've set that up. Now, some things are a little more awkward. So if we want to copy from one vector, one of our ranges, to another, like we would just assign one vector to another, we have to do this. We allocate the new space for the new one, copy the size, and manually copy the elements. So why can't we just do that? And if you're thinking this doesn't compile, it does. It's perfectly valid, it compiles and runs. So what's wrong with just saying range vec2 equals vec instead of all this code? Or at least different. Yes?
So we need a decopy here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we need to copy all the data from vec to vec2, but if we just use vec2 equals to vec, it is just the address it is copied.
Yeah.
The content is still the same at the same place.
Yeah. So the problem is we would just copy this data pointer. So if we just did this, our two vecs would point to the same data, modifying one, modify the other. And if we freed one, we'd erroneously free the other. So that's probably not what we want. In C++, you're used to people who implement vector and things like that being able to override what assignment and initialization does. That is not possible in C. You're going to have to do something like this or call a function to do it yourself. It's not going to be the case that equals is going to automatically do that for you. Yes?
Are there overrides in C?
No. So there's no way of changing what this does in C to do the right thing. You're going to have to do something different. Other questions? Okay. So as you probably know, C has signed and unsigned types. I've mostly not used this distinction, but there's some things I want to get across about signed versus unsigned. And on our lab machines, these are the ranges. So signed ints are 32 bits. They have the usual range for 2's complements, which maybe you remember from 2150, or wherever you learned it. And unsigned have the range from 0 to 2 to the k minus 1. And for the most part, things work intuitively, but there's some very notable cases where signed and unsigned types do things that you don't expect from your understanding of how they work. So one thing is, what rationally would this output? This were doing the most logical thing. So who thinks it would output 0 if it were doing the most logical thing? Thinks it would output 1 if it were doing the most logical thing. So more votes for 1, because -1 is less than 0. But of course, since I'm giving the example, the output is 0. This is false, which is very confusing. And the short answer for what's happening here is don't compare signed to unsigned. First, convert to a value which a type which holds all your values. And what's going on is that the compiler is doing a conversion like this, but it's converting to unsigned int for you, which isn't very helpful. So if you want this to work, you can cast to, say, long, which on our lab machines holds all possible values that can fit in an int or an unsigned int. And the reason it happens is that there's this general rule that the compiler needs to convert both operands to a comparison to the same type. And there's also a rule about how this happens. And the rule says, basically, use int if you can. Otherwise, use a type from this list. And so this actually converts both of the values to int. Thank you very much. Converts to the wrong type, it turns out. Generally, you could try to figure out what the rule is, but really, you should just be converting to a type which fits everything, and or not comparing signed and unsigned values and expecting anything to work. Because the compiler will often do the wrong thing by converting one of the operands to signed or unsigned for you, and possibly changing the value. Okay. So I alluded to last time that there were standards for C. I'll give a brief history of those standards. And so C started with a book, basically. So there's a book called KNR, published in 1978, which is extremely different from modern C. You might come across this, you might not. And this changed a lot when some people decided that they wanted to standardize it. The American National Standards Committee wanted to define what C was and let multiple people implement it. And so ANSI standardized C, and this is sometimes called C89 or C90 after the year of the standard. It's C90 for the ISO version, International Standards Organization version of it. They're all the same thing. And you can request that your compiler use this version with these options for GCC. And there have been later standards. So for example, in 1999, the International Standards Organization updated C, and this added some things you might care about, like declaring variables in the middle of a block and using / comments. Things you probably thought were features of C for all time, but weren't. And people are still adding things to C. You'll get very variable support from recent C standards. But it's good to be aware that there is a standard which specifies what happens. And that there are multiple versions of it. And this is what your compiler options refer to if you request a specific version. Yeah?
So which one are the compiler using by default?
The compiler by default is likely using C99 plus some extra stuff, plus being a little more permissive than it would need to be. Okay. And so speaking of standards, I have an example here, some code with test, which adds 1 to a number and sees if that's greater than the number. Very simple function. And then we call it with int max. So this is a comparison, so it's going to return 0 or 1. And we're passing int max, which is the largest possible integer. That's a constant defined in limits.h for the largest possible integer. So who here thinks that this should return 0? Should print out 0, I should say. Who thinks it should print out 1? So no one thinks it should print out 1. And it turns out that it often prints out zero. So if you just compile this normally, without any special flags, it will print out zero. If you compile it with enough optimizations, it will print out one. And you might quite reasonably say, the compiler is broken. Right? I know that adding something to int max is supposed to wrap around. That's how 2's complements works. So it should produce a big negative number, which shouldn't be greater. And that's a very rational thing to think. And the people who made the C standard did not agree with you. And the reason that this happens is what test gets compiled to. So with optimizations, the compiler said, oh, adding one to a number, that's going to be bigger than the number. Then we're comparing it to numbers, so the result of this is always one. I'm just going to put one in my return value and make this function much, much faster, as opposed to this complicated version here where we actually add one and actually do the comparison and actually extract the less than bit from the flags and put it in our return value. And the people who made the C standard decided that they wanted compilers to be able to do optimizations like this. And so they said that overflow on signed integers is what they call undefined behavior. The compiler can do whatever it likes. So even though rationally the thing that should naturally happen is wrapping around, the standard just doesn't say what happens. And the compiler actually takes advantage of this. And you can see the motivation for doing it, because it's really convenient to be able to optimize things like this rather than need to worry every time you see number plus one, is this going to overflow? But you'll come across this because you're going to write code which inadvertently uses this undefined behavior. So undefined behavior means compilers can do whatever they want. So most commonly, you'll see things like this, where the compiler just changes the answer. The compiler took advantage of the fact that it's not allowed, it's undefined, for you to add one to a number, that one number, and have it overflow if it's a signed number, and therefore optimize this into some sort of broken code. And sometimes it doesn't do that, and that's fine, because the standard says it's not defined what happens when you overflow like this. Now, for unsigned integers, it turns out, if I just change this to unsigned, this optimization is illegal. That the standard actually says for unsigned numbers that it has to actually work wrap around like you expect. They just decided for signed numbers, they don't want to require compilers to do that. It was just a choice they made, it's just arbitrary. So any questions about this here? Okay, So signed integer overflow and underflow is probably the most subtle kind of undefined behavior that we're going to come across in this class, but there are a lot of them. Basically, anytime the people who define what C is didn't want to say what would really happen, it's undefined behavior. So another big case is that technically, when you access a pointer out of bounds, that's undefined behavior. So if the compiler sees you accessing out of the bounds of the array, even if you logically know how things are laid out in memory, the compiler is allowed to do this sort of trick where it says, oh, you can't do that. I don't need to worry about that going into something else in memory. I can just assume that you aren't going out of bounds of the array. So the compiler doesn't actually need to follow our model of the machine, because the C standard has given them the leeway to do this. They can do whatever. Another example is writing read-only data. So when I showed this example, right. When I showed this example earlier, I said that this pointer probably points to read-only data, suggesting that if you try to write to it, you'll get an error. So writing to that pointer is in fact undefined behavior. So the compiler can cause whatever it wants to happen. So hopefully it will crash your program when you try to write to that. But it could do something much less intuitive. Like it could allow you to change the string and have the characters in that string be shared with another string constant in your program, which will mysteriously change now. That is also legal. So the C standard just said, we don't care what happens if you try to write to read-only data. We're not going to require compilers to actually enforce that, though of course it would be nice if they did. The C standard could have instead said that this is going to crash, but that would require compilers to, on some systems, like track where read-only data is and do something before every time you write through a pointer. So rather than require that, the C standard just said, we don't care what happens. So another example is integer divide by zero. That's undefined behavior. It's not the case that that's guaranteed to crash. It could not crash. You just can't do it. If you try to do it, who knows what will happen. And next lecture, we're going to talk about bit shifting, and certain kinds of bit shifts are also undefined behavior. So I'd note that a key aspect of undefined behavior, which makes it so pernicious, is that it varies. So like the sizes of types, that's not undefined behavior. It varies between systems, but it's the same. It's consistent. It's documented. Undefined behavior like varies depending on optimization flags. It varies depending on where in your code it is. So don't expect it to be inconsistent. Don't expect it to be documented. And beware that you could run into it in cases where our model of how the machine works and how you would generate code might not agree with what your compiler generates, especially if it's trying to make your code really fast. So that's what I have for today. Apparently we go, so I'll take questions first. Any questions? Yeah. So with an out-of-bounds pointer, okay. So the rule is, so logically, the rule we think of is that when you have a pointer and you access something that's in that holes in memory I showed you, like app below the stack, you know, above the heap, that hole, that's an error because that memory's not allocated, and that's the only thing which is a problem. So the rule in C is that the C standard specifies is stricter than that. They don't know what the program layout is, so they just say that if you take a pointer to something and try to use it to access anything other than the object, like the array or the thing you got from malloc, etc., that it came from, that's an error. But that's undefined behavior. So if the compiler sees you accessing an array, and accessing out of bounds of the array, it doesn't have to consider that that array is next to something else in memory. It can just assume that that doesn't happen and generate code which optimizes away that access. And that's what I mean by that being undefined.